Yes, thank you, Fred, and thanks the organizers for being flexible and even shifting talks according to the will of the audience. And thanks the audio people for enabling me to use my Linux computer to present this talk. It's not easy. So my talk has a quite long title, Short-Term Synaptic Plasticity, Inhibitory Interneuron, and the Response of Cortical Circuits to Thalamic Input. And the work was done, most of the work was done with Itay Chayut, a student from Ben-Gurion University, and Barry Connors from Brown University with his former postdoc Erica, now the University of Pittsburgh, and Chris Richardson. So this is a simple scheme of the cortical circuit. These are the RS neuron, regular spiking cells. These are the excitatory interneurons. And this neuron, this symbol will represent all the excitatory interneurons. So there are some neurons that are denoted to be intrinsic bursting neurons. They are here also. One group of regular spiking cortical excitatory neurons. And there are two important groups of inhibitory interneurons. Of course, there are more, but I will focus here on two main types. This is from Berlin, Gibson, and Connors. So these are the fast spiking neurons. These are the more classical interneuron that you think when you think about an interneuron that can fire very brief spikes and do it at very high rate. And this is another group of neurons that is called LTS, low threshold spikes. It has also other names. These neurons express the express somatostatin. These neurons express paravalbumin. So some people call them somatostatin expressing cells. According to morphology, these guys in layer 5 are named Martinotti cells. And there is also a name gene cell. Genes means a green fluorescent protein, inhibitory neurons. This is a subtype of this kind of cell in mice that can express this green fluorescent protein. So in experiment, people can easily find them. So these are the fine properties of these subtypes of LTS neurons. It's not here. So regarding circuitry, RS neurons excite chemically themselves and the two populations of interneurons. These guys inhibit themselves and those guys. These guys inhibit chemically RS neurons and FS neurons, but not or almost not themselves. So LTS to LTS neurons are not mutually coupled, and FS cells are coupled electrically to themselves, and LTS neurons are coupled electrically to themselves. So this is the circuit with respect to thalamic input, RS neurons, and FS neurons, but at least according to the Connors group, not LTS neurons, receive excitatory thalamic input.
Sorry, the
yes.
LTS and FS, those are not pyramidal cells, they're
inner. No. These RS cells are either pyramidal cells or in layer 4, they can be spiny stellate cells. These guys, FS and LTS, are interneurons, inhibitory interneurons, they are not pyramidal cells. Yes?
I mess up. The gray versus the black means what? The strength or something? Or is that just to distinguish?
I think that what they want to say is that which guys, which type, okay, that's a good question. At the beginning, I saw that this means kind of facilitation and depression, but not here. So what I can see is say that maybe the gray means that the guys that are related to the LTS neurons, connection from the LTS neurons.
Are the resistors gap?
So LTS neurons are coupled to each other by gap junctions. FS are coupled to each other by gap junctions. But that's it. So FS and LTS are rarely or almost not coupled by gap junctions.
And these gap junction couplings remain stable throughout life, or how old are the slices?
When they do the experiment, they do it with a juvenile slice, means it's 20-something data. So they are adults, and they are young adults or teenagers, David Kleinfeld used to say. There is some development, yes. But it's clearly not an effect of young age. So you can find it also in older age. It's not like a gap junction, for example, in the thalamus, in the sensory part of the thalamus, they disappear when the animal mature. So this is the content of this talk. So first, I'll talk about a project related to fast packing neurons. This is kind of a side issue, but since questions related to this project emerges during yesterday and before, I want to say something about this project, dynamics of fast packing neurons. This is published. Short-term plasticity of RS to LTS and LTS to RS synapses. I'll talk about experimental observation, facilitation and the prevention of activation. I'll raise an hypothesis about one role of LTS neurons. Then I describe the method, the Sodic's marker model of depression and facilitation. I will present my work on RS-LTS-FS networks with Sodic's marker synaptic dynamics. After I get the conclusion, I try to convince you that more experimental work needs to be done, and I will show some preliminary results regarding experimental work on this connection, and also some preliminary modeling results. So yesterday, Herbie also talked about, Herbert Levin also talked about short-term synaptic plasticity, and he started from very detailed models of the synapse and tries to go up. So this was a bottom-up approach, and I represent more top-down approach. So I start with simple models that can be solved analytically, and then try to add more and more, and of course make them more complex.
I mean, what is the question that you
answer? One moment, wait.
Let me rephrase that. What's it take? I mean, I see seven different topics. What's the take-home message?
The take-home message is at the end, not beginning. So one moment. So the first project is about the effect of D and sodium D current, which is potassium current with slow inactivation, and sodium currents on the firing pattern of fast packing neurons. As I said, this is kind of a side project to this talk, but it's related to several talks that we heard in the last few days. So in that case, we wanted to model using a conductance-based model the many firing patterns that fast packing neurons exhibit. So we focus on two currents. One of these is this slow activating potassium current, and the second one is our hero today, the sodium current, the transient sodium current. So we used a conductance-based approach or Hutchinson-Huxley-like model. This is M infinity, this is H infinity. INA is equal to GNA M cube H multiplied by V minus VNA. H, M is instantaneous. H has a dynamics. Tau H is on the order of 100 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds. And turns out that what is important, really important here, is the window current, which is GNA M infinity square, H infinity, which is the value of the sodium current, assuming the voltage is fixed. And it's, of course, very much affected by these two half maximum voltages, theta H from H infinity and theta M for M infinity. And if theta M is minus 24, which means relatively small window current, the fast packing neuron is a class 2 neuron. This means that the SI curve has a minimal value below which the neuron cannot fire, class 2 according to Hodgkin. And if you plot the phase diagram, this is GD, the strength of the D current, and this is I applied in response to step current. We can get several firing patterns that the neuron can exhibit. For example, if GD is small and I applied, of course, if I applied this very small, then the neuron is quiescent, but it's not so surprising. If I apply it larger, the neuron can fire with no delay. If we increase GD, it can exhibit a delay before firing with or without one spike at the beginning. That's something you showed, Bill Spence showed 2 days ago. And if the neuron GD is even larger, the neuron can stutter or burst, as you can see here.
Sorry, Devin, did you explain what GD is?
GD is the conductance of the G current. The D current is the slowly inactivating potassium current, the same current that Bill Spann was talking about 2 days ago. So, by the way, depending on the properties of the firing, this D current can cause adaptation, which means an interspike interval can increase, or it causes reverse adaptation, the interspike interval can decrease. We analyze it using bifurcation theory, but I don't have time to speak about here. And in order to get stuttering, by the way, you really need to get adaptation and not reverse adaptation.
What's happening with your spike heights? How come the first spike in the stutter is so short?
The first?
Your first spike is shorter than all the others and has a lot higher threshold.
Ah, yeah. So, let's see what we got in this model. If the window cut is even larger, then the neuron switches from class 2 to class 1. It can fire at very low rate, and it can show a delay if GD is small, or it can show no delay if GD is small, or show delay if GD is large. Here, there is delay here, and in between there is a regime you can fire in doublets. So the sodium current together with the window current of the sodium current together with GD controls the firing pattern and of this neuron. And to answer about this part, to answer Peter. Hi, Peter. Take a message that you can get many firing types by just, or most of the firing patterns that you can get experimentally by changing GD and the window current or some current, but not so much. So unlike some people that claim that there are many, many subtypes of cortical fast packing cell, we say probably there is one class with some heterogeneity, and via bifurcation, and bifurcation theory, heterogeneity is translated to different firing classes you can see in experiment.
So this is
the second information of this part, from this part. From that part, for this three slides.
There's going to be seven.
You mean seven take-home messages?
Yeah, you mean seven, yes. So don't leave now. Please, stay.
Sorry, so here you're also varying this D current, which is this slow inactivating.
The conductance of the slowly inactivating potassium current.
And I is the current.
I is the applied current that you inject to the.
And so how do you vary the strength of the window current?
No. This can be done, but it's much more effective to vary M infinity here. So if you switch M infinity by just 4 millivolts. Just 4 millivolts. So here it's 24, minus 24, and here it's minus 28. The whole bifurcation diagram switches. So if you want, there is kind of a Takas-Bogdanov second or codimension 2 bifurcation, but
is
I don't mean
it. Prediction that you can.
Can you say it again?
Prediction that you want to have tested?
Yes, we have some experimental results with Jeremy Tai and found these two types of. With Jeremy Tai, we found these two.
On the window current?
We can't measure the window current, okay? If somebody can tell me, well, I can.
Also, your new colleague, that's when you look at the Aspen paper, measured window current, actually, the absence of window current in the sonar.
Not in fast packing cell. One, two. As we discussed with Mike yesterday, it's not so important if you have a window current or you have a persistent sodium current.
Uh-huh.
Now, according to Peter Jonas, there is no persistent sodium current in these cells, but it's clear that without window current and without persistent sodium current, if you give a slow depolarizing current, the neuron will never fire, but it's clear that these neurons fire, so there is either that, this or that.
Or something that you don't know.
Or something that you don't know. So, let's go to the main topic of this talk, which is short-term synaptic plasticity and the effect of this property or phenomenon on the cortical circuits. So from many groups, including Barikonos, Henry Markham, and others, it's clear from the literature that at least in response to several presynaptic spikes, RS to LTS synapses facilitate. So this is an RS neuron, excitatory neuron. This is an LTS neuron, an inhibitor neuron from this type. They inject current pulses into this neuron, making it firing right here, and they measure the response of this neuron. And you can see the response to the first spike here is very, very small. And then the response to the other spikes facilitates dramatically. In contrast, if you look at the LTS to RS synapses, this synapses depress, the response to the first spike is much larger than the response to the subsequent spikes. So one result of it is what Henry Markham and his colleague called, and also Massimo Scanziani, Andrea, hi. Massimo Scanziani called frequency dependent disynaptic inhibition. So what is the meaning of that? So here, this is from Berger et al, 2010. This paper has just been published in PLOS Biology by the Markham group and Zilberberg. So these are two pyramidal cells. Pyramidal cells are excitatory cells. Most of them are regular sparking cells, RS. And this is a Martinotti cell. And the Martinotti cells belong to the class of LTS neurons. So suppose they make this neuron fire. So this neuron fires. At the beginning, this guy does nothing. Eventually, under certain conditions, sometimes it can fire, but under the effect of only one pyramidal cell firing. Actually, what they did later, they say that if four pyramidal cells fire, all the other pyramidal cells in the area get this phenomena that I tell you. So firing of only four pyramidal cells within a short distance cause all the other neurons to see this effect, which is the synaptic inhibition. This Martinotti cell fire with a delay because of facilitation, and then they inhibit with a delay, of course, again, this pyramidal cell. So here there are only two neurons. This neuron causes this inhibition, disynaptically inhibits this neuron via the Martinotti LTS neuron. So what's the meaning of that? Who needs it? Who needs the LTS neuron? So there are several hypotheses, and I explore one of them by Zilberberg and Markham, which is the involvement in feedback self-inhibition suggests that this pathway through the LTS neuron is important in preventing overactivation of cortical pyramidal cells, which may be important in the prevention of epilepsy. So this idea gains support, some support from the fact that correlation was found between the selective loss of hippocampal somatostatin positive neurons, the cousins of this LTS neuron in the hippocampus, and epileptic state by this group people and the Benary group. But this, you can never say too much out of it because nobody knows whether this is a result of the effect of LTS neuron one moment, or the cause. Maybe epileptic activity caused death of LTS neurons. So, who knows? Yes?
I'm a little confused. So, we know that without inhibition, the brain is epileptic, right?
Right.
So, inhibitory cells are always involved in preventing overactivation of.
Sure.
Exactly is the question.
Okay. Okay. So,
maybe why is this an answer?
It's not an answer, it's a question. So, inhibition, fast-packing inhibition, fast-packing. Here I'm talking about LTS. In addition, there are FS neurons and other type of neurons. So fast-packing neurons are active even if the firing rate is low. I mean, naively speaking. You see that you may be more right than you think, but only after doing a calculation. So before doing the calculation, naively, people say, well, LTS neurons fire always fire. LTS neurons, if the firing rate is small, are quiescent. So if they're quiescent, they don't do too much. But if the activity starts to increase considerably, then LTS neuron fire, and they inhibit the RS neuron. So according to this hypothesis that you want to explore, this is kind of a safeguard against epilepsy. If firing is low, let's say 10 hertz, then LTS neurons almost don't do anything. And if the firing rate is much higher, then they fire like crazy and depress or inhibit the regular spiking cells. And the question is it? Yes?
But if they depress after one spike, then they do one spike and then the network...
No, network will start to be active, and then LTS neurons are active, and they inhibit regular spiking cells. So of course, you can ask, what is the steady state? And that's exactly what you want to say.
But if they depress strongly, then they
exactly.
Inhibition, and then that's it.
Yes. So the question is this role limited by the RTS to LS synaptic depression? Exactly. This is the question that Fleur and I ask. So we ask you answer this question via modeling, and now I want to stop a little bit and give you some background to modeling of a short-term synaptic plasticity before presenting my own result. So when we talk about short-term synaptic plasticity, we talk about the presynaptic terminal and the postsynaptic terminal. Most people think that most activity related to depression facilitation is because of the presynaptic side, although there are some effects on the postsynaptic side that I will not describe. And here are the assumptions. First, there are several independent release sites. It can be in the same synapse, or effectively, there can be several boutons, like two excitatory cells are coupled on average by seven morphological synapses, morphological boutons, according to Henry Marker. But effectively, this can be one synapse. From a theoretical point of view, it can be one big synapse, although it's distributed in many areas along the dendritic tree. So the N is the number of release sites. Q is the quantum value, it's the value of transmitter that is released by one vesicle. X is the fraction of release sites with vesicles. So there are release sites, there are vesicles. If there is a vesicle ready to be released, that's okay. If there is no vesicle, even if spikes come, there will be no release. And U is the conditional probability of release. So assuming there is a vesicle ready for release, and a spike comes, U is the conditional probability that there will be release of this vesicle. So the average amount of transmitter release, let's call it T, is N, and N multiplied by Q, multiplied by X, multiplied by U. On the presynaptic side, S is the probability of a synaptic channel, let's say AMPA, to be opened. So ds to the t is equal to a constant kf multiplied by t, this presynaptic type, multiplied by minus f to prevent, to allow saturation, and of course multiplied by a delta function, conical delta function, if there is spike at the time t, minus KRS. This is the simplest Markov model you can write for the postsynaptic site, and it goes back to the stacks and to Wong and Rizzo in 1992 or 1 or even before. So these are the main assumptions. Now, depression. Depression is easy to treat, and people did it in the 50s and then 70s, and then Abbott, Varela, Sen, and Nelson, and Truex and Markham studied again in 1997. And let's say that there is a trend of N spikes coming after a time of quiescent. So N is the number of spikes, and minus means before the spikes, plus means after the spikes. So X and plus is equal to X and minus multiplied by 1 minus U and plus. U N is the conditional probability of release. So 1 minus U means how many vesicles were not released, and that's what you have after a spike. Between spikes, one assumes that the places, that the sites that are not occupied by vesicles, get basically exponentially. So 1 minus x and plus decreases exponentially, and 1 minus this is the number of vesicles of sites that have vesicles. So here you get a map from the response of to the n spikes, the response of n plus 1 spike, and of course x and n minus, if there are no spikes coming for a long time, x and minus is 1. All the sites are occupied. So that's the equation for depression. For facilitation, the situation is a little bit more complicated because there are, as you know from Herbie, there are several models, but one important model is the model of Bertram Stanley and Sherman in 1996, and Richard Bertram published several papers about that. And this goes back to the old idea of Katz and Rami Rachamimov from the 60s, that there is a calcium center, probably this synaptotagmin protein, that needs to bind to, let's say, 4 calcium ion, and each binding site obeys this equation. Dj is, or D means close in this language, close, B is open without calcium, here is with calcium, and you need all the binding sites to be connected to calcium in order to this voltage calcium sensor to be active and allow release. So you already have 4 equations of this Markov form. Kj plus is the rate in this direction, Kj minus is the rate in this direction, and sigma is the expected value of this to be coupled to calcium. And of course, you need not the release probability of the multiplications of all these sigma. Let's ignore correlation for simplicity. That's what they did. So you get a simple Markov equation, d sigma j to dt, j goes from 1 to 4, is equal to minus kj minus, plus kj plus ka sigma, that's what goes in this direction, minus kj plus, this is what goes in this direction, minus kj plus calcium. Yes?
The one important difference of this to, say, Mayer's model.
To which model?
Any Mayer's models is that here there's no compatibility. So binding of one calcium leaves the affinity of the other binding site unaffected.
Exactly.
That's what the
yes, the, okay. What I want to do here is to since the Zurich's Markov model became kind of the generic model that everybody uses. And since the Zurich Markov model is actually based on the Bertram model, I think it's important to explain what are the steps, and then you can say, okay, this is still incorrect, this is still incorrect, this is still incorrect, this is still incorrect. But first, let's understand what's going on in how you derive the Zurich Markov model from the Bertram model. And of course, there are many arguments. Richard, say this way. Even Bertram and Artie Sherman have at least 4 other models that they studied. So they are competing models, and even for synapses that are much more studied than this cortical synapses, like the Kalidov Helix, like the neurovascular junction, people still argue after 50 years. So some people say, okay, let's take the simplest model, which currently this is the Zurich Markov model, and see what's going on here. Some people say, okay, we need to go more than that. So, and the second part of the talk. Okay.
Good.
Let's see what you can do. In the next of the talk, we'll actually address the question and kind of define the rule of the game. But first, let's start with the simplest model, because so many people use it. So this is the Bertram model. Now, Misha and Henry went several steps ahead. First, they say, okay, 4 is too much. Let's take only 1. So instead of, out of the 4, 1 is very, very fast. This is responsible for the initial response, so one is okay. Let's take one step that is slow and ignore the other. So we consider a spike train after a long quiescent period. N is the spike number. During the spike, K plus CA, this assumption, is much larger than K minus. So calcium is bound to the sites, release to the binding site. And of course, without calcium, calcium unbinds to the site. So you can say that sigma N plus, which is the probability of the binding, now N is the substrate of time, because there is only one binding site according to Misha. Make it simple. So the sigma N plus is 1 minus 1 of my sigma N minus multiplied by this. This is the simple solution of this equation. Okay, again, assuming that if there is no spikes before, sigma N minus equals 0. So sigma 1 minus equals 0, sigma 1 plus equals that, and this Misha and Henry defined as capital U. So this is the probability of, conditional probability of release, assuming there are no spikes after, there have been no spikes for a long time. Then sigma N plus is, you use this, and instead of this, you write, from this term, you write 1 over U minus U, then this is the equation you get. Is sigma N plus 1 minus, means what's the conditional probability of release just before the next spike? This is sigma N plus. Okay, actually, this is the, not conditional probability of release. This is the how many calcium sites are bound. This is sigma N plus multiplied by E by minus T minus tau F, divided by tau F. Tau F is this. So this is the exponential decay. And tau F is the facilitation time constant. And if you plug it in the equation, you get UN plus 1 equal to UN E by minus T divided by tau F plus capital U, 1 minus UN E by minus T divided by tau F. And this is the Zollick-Markram equation for facilitation. So again, the Zollick-Markram facilitation is a simplification of the Bertrand model. And now it's important to say that for the transmission release, for each spike, you get Tn equal to n, number of release sites, multiplied by Q, the quantum content, Xn minus, before the spike, it should be Un plus. So actually this is, here there is a, here it's plus, and but here, because it's Cree, you don't see this. Right, so this is Un plus. Yes.
If you kept all four sigmas in, then you get a model that's nothing like the Zollick-Markram model? Is that correct?
You always ask a question about the end of my talk. Maybe you get more facilitation, but
yeah,
I believe me, I'll answer you.
What do you say?
I'll answer you at the end of the talk.
All right, well, you can ask me now, yes, no, maybe, approximately the same.
You get much more, you get much more facilitation.
And is it more consistent with experiments?
You'll see, some of them, but you'll see. What do you say?
It's okay.
Okay, so there is one more step that Misha and Henry and Klaus Pavelczyk went. And I think that's one reason why their model is so successful and so many people use it, is to transfer the spiking model, neuron model, to a rate model. So Misha and Klaus Pavelczyk and Henry Markham generated a rate model out of the model that I had just shown, that is for synapses, for a spiking neurons. And now X and U are kind of meaningful values for the variables X and U, and they derived it. I will not follow the derivation here, but still dx to the t is equal to minus 1 minus x divided by tau r. Tau r is the recovery from depression time constants minus x u m, and m is the firing rate of the presynaptic population. And du to the t is equal to capital U minus small u divided by tau f plus capital U 1 minus u m. So this you can use in a rate model, and Misha and Henry, Misha use it actually in many papers using the old Wilson-Kahn representation of the rate model. Now, in this work, I would adapt the more modern representation of Owen Schricke, David Hansel, and Chaim Sopolinsky of the rate model. They derived a rate model from a convexity-based model, and this derivation is based on many work that many people did before, John Winsor and Paul Frenkel, Bart Ehrmantraut, Wolfgang Gerstner, but they did, I think, they formulated the final version of the model, and they showed it can reduce a convexity-based model to a rate model, but the variables are variables of the synapses. S, S to T is equal to minus S to minus S over tau S. Tau S is the synaptic time constant for amperes, let's say 2 milliseconds, plus UXN. Now, I don't enter here in the full model, it should be multiplied by 1 minus S. If S can be so large to prevent S from being larger than 1, I don't include here this 1 of minus S term. I don't take into account saturation, and for the purpose of making the model simpler and allow analytical treatment. M is the firing rate of the pre-symmetric population, and beta is the gain that many people, including Fred and David McCormick, talked about this yesterday. So beta is the gain of the input to the neuron minus the threshold. I external is the input from outside of the network. I sin is the input from inside the network. And this plus is the linear threshold function. So if x is smaller than 0, x plus is 0. Otherwise, it is x plus. So for the cortical model that I presented here before, these are the equations for the RS neurons, for the LTS neurons, and for the FS neurons. Each one has this different beta, and these are the input, and these are the coupling to the other population. I use metric notation, so the first subscript is the represents or denotes the postsynaptic population, and the second one denotes the postsynaptic population, and this denotes the presynaptic population. The variable tau r and tau f turn out to be very important. So we actually took them from the R2R population, we took them from Ron Markram and the people. And for these two connections, we took them from Zilberberg and Markram. And for the other connection, there is not so much information in the literature. So some of them we took from Henry Markram, assuming that the synapses, the cells that he refers to, and he has his own notation, are really the fast-packing cells. Anyway, what's important here is that for the RS2 electrons, U is pretty small, let's say 0.09. And tau facilitation is large, so this connection facilitates. We ignore the depression here, where our RS to RS and L to S to RS a connection depressed. And this depression time constant is pretty long, according to Zilberberg and Markham. So let's solve the simplest circuits that we can think about. So as we said, we go from top to down. We start with the simplest model. RS neurons getting input and connected to LTS neurons that do not get any external input. So if there are no LTS neurons, you get simply what you put inside the model, the linear threshold behavior. But if LTS, introduce LTS to RS inhibition, GRL from LTS to RS, you increase it, you see that the curve is shifted above the firing threshold of LTS neurons. If LTS neurons are quiescent, of course, they do nothing. But as soon as they start active, they start to affect the curve. So for the steady state, we can solve this analytically. Steady state means over a long time, the resting state. So there are two main results here. First, the effect of the LTS neurons on the shape of the MRIR curve, this curve, is stronger strongest just above the LTS filing threshold. So it's not, you don't have to wait until the filing rate is very, very long, very, very large, for the LTS cells to be effective. They are effective here just above the filing threshold. Reserve number two, for large filing rate, all what these guys do is to reduce the filing rate of the network by a constant value. And you can calculate the value. This constant value is GRL multiplied by the ratio between these two time scales, tau S, the synaptic time constant, and tau R, the recovery from depression time constant. So this is kind of surprising, but if you remember Flair's comments, this can be very explained very simply. So at high filing rate, ML, the synaptic input from LTS neurons to RS neurons is constant. Because, as Misha and Henry showed many years ago, the PSP amplitude scales at high rate, like 1 over ML, and you multiply it by ML, which is the number of spikes, you get a constant term. Again, here. So, this is a constant term because of depression. So the role of depression, at least depression according to the Mark-Ramczuk model, the simplest value is that, indeed, if you ask whether LTS neuron can protect the circuit, yes, they can, but to a certain extent, by a constant value that does not increase with IR. And this, by the way, one more sentence, this is the firing rate of the LTS neuron. This also reaches a straight line at high rate. Yes?
So this business of limiting frequency in cortex, well, isn't that what you were just talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Where, you know, when the rate goes up, you basically can't get anything more based on the dynamics of the synapse, right?
Exactly. With the Mark-Ramczuk model.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So the problem with that in cortex, I mean, it's so, right, it's true when you think about it in, you know, if you have a fixed number of neurons, but in cortex, one of the things that happens, I think, I mean, is that as you increase activity, you recruit more and more neurons to be involved. I mean, that sort of only works if you're saying we've got this fixed number of neurons at all these different levels of activity of, say, the LTS neurons, and you're not bringing more in. But as soon as you bring more in, limiting frequency isn't going to really be...
Right. So if you add some heterogeneity, you can add some heterogeneity and say in the curve we'll take it more time until you get this limiting behavior, but eventually at high rate, if you assume all the neurons are recruited, eventually go back to this level. But there is another solution to that, that will show the end, but... Yes?
So, it means that LTS neurons have to work harder and harder, but their contribution is just the same.
The contribution?
To reduction, to controlling excitation. So
it's fixed.
When you come to that graph, where is the impact at high...
Good question. So you don't, first cortical neuron under normal condition should not go into the pediatric state. This is a disease, it's not what you want to do. So really what I say here, LTS neurons are active under their normal firing rate, which is about 10 hertz, at least according to the Connor scope.
Sorry, are these
RS
neurons, are they class 1 or class 2?
Okay, RS neuron classically, I think Aaron Friedman and Mike Gutten did it 20 years ago or something, are class 1. They can fire at pretty low rate. So with SS neuron that are classically class 2, you can say, what is the validity of rate model for class 2 neuron, which is a big question by itself, but let's forget it for now.
Yeah, I was just wondering, if it's class 2, then it depends on the phase where the inhibition arrives. Whether the inhibition will be excited or inhibited.
If it's class 2, then you can say there is a small regime of bistability. But as I can show you, there are much more important issues that you should care before that. So again, the approach is going from top down. To start with the simplest model, to see what is the global approach, and then to refine. By the way, now with this model, you really understand what's going on. So you can understand the value, what happens if you change tau r, the recovery time constant. If the recovery time constant is large, then the effect of the LTS neurons is much smaller, simply because it takes the synapse a long time to recover. So under steady state, it has much less, it's much less effective. And if tau r is zero, then this is the only case where, in the limited case, you don't get this constant value. So if without depression, the effect of LTS neuron would be much harder, but much stronger, but there is depression.
I think the time scale of the transient.
The
time scale of the transient. How long do you?
The time scale of the transient. Good. Thank you. So, the transient, when you talk about, not about steady state, but about transient, then, of course, you need to speak about the dynamics of the input. So let's start with a step current, which means the input is a zero, and then it goes to the value IR. So this is the Heaviside function. Okay, what you see here are the firing rate of a RS neuron and LTS neurons as function of time for three value of IR, 0.25, 0.38, and 0.5. And if IR is small, just above threshold, for that just as for the LTS threshold, then you increase current, the excited population fire, and then the firing rate, and then LTS neurons come to play, LTS neurons come to play, even if the firing rate is small, and then decrease the activity of RS neuron. Okay? Please note that there is a delay because of facilitation. As you saw in the experimental work of Markram and Zierberg, there is delay until LTS neurons start to fire. And this delay decreases with IR, and you can calculate it also analytically. Now, if IR becomes larger, then what you can see is that LTS neuron reduce the activity of RS neuron, and then the activity rises again. Although the activity of LTS neuron continue to rise, and this is because depression. And this is because depression, this is because tau R is so long. Tau R is more than a second, according to Zerbe Markham. This is the slowest time scale in the problem. So here, although the activity of the LTS neuron increases, its effect is decreases due to depression. Eventually, everything reaches a steady state. So the steady state for this problem of the RS LTS neurons is the only solution at long time. Only stable solution. Only solution. Now, with RS to RS synapses. With RS to RS synapses, the situation is similar, except that you have another term here at long time. So at long time, the RS population also contributes a constant term, but this term is, of course, now positive. GR, sorry for those people who don't see, you see? GRR, tau SRR divided by tau R as S. But you know, the effect of RS to RS neuron that's low firing rate or depressing is not so important, was studied by many people, and you all know that if GRR is strong enough, you get by stability, so the network can be either silent or fire at relatively low rates. So here, this dotted curve means unstable. So if you just think about steady state, that's fine, that's not so interesting. But if you think about dynamics, you can see that in response to a step current, the network can show oscillation. They decay with time for this value of tau r. Again, this is also not new because in the Wilson-Cohen model, the relationship between R to R connections, RS to RS connection and oscillation was described before. And if the GRR is too strong, and this is for Peter, so please, Peter. If the GRR is too strong, you can get oscillation also in this model. the oscillation are fast, the frequency can reach 40, 60 hertz. You can get it through a Hopf bifurcation of the fixed point of the rest state, and you can get here, when GRR is between these values, you can get oscillation. The firing rate increases with the GRR, and that's why the frequency actually decreases with GRR. If you want to see the full phase diagram, so this is GRR, this is the input IR, you can get this limit cycle, this oscillation, only when IR is small. If IR is large, you'll never get it. And there is a small regime of stability here, when you can get here both fixed point and oscillations. During the oscillations, MR and ML go more or less in the same phase. So RS neuron fire, immediately a few milliseconds later, ATS neuron fire, so the firing time overlap. That by itself is also interesting, but important to show that it's different than the new slow oscillation that I described soon. With FS neuron, so according to the naive interpretation, LTS neuron can protect the circuit against overexcitation epilepsy. FS neuron can protect the can affect the initial response, but turned out that even in a steady state, the behavior at long time is actually very similar, at least qualitatively. So this is an RS population coupled to an FS population. FS population gets input from outside, and this is GRF from the inhibition from F to R. And as you increase it, you see that the activity of the RS population decreases. Okay, it's inhibition. And because the IF neurons are active also without RS population firing, because they get their own input, they are active also at low rate. But see what's going on. Because the RS to FS synapses depress, this means that the activity of the fast packing cell reaches a certain value, whatever the activity of the RS neurons is. So I can calculate the maximum firing rate of the FS population. And this means that the synapses from FS to RS cannot exceed a certain value. And because they cannot exceed a certain value, what the FS neuron can do is also to reduce the activity of RS neuron by a constant value. So it's because of difference value, LTS to RS neuron, synapses depress, FS neuron simply cannot fire above a certain value, but the effect of the RS neuron is the same. They reduce the firing at a high rate by a constant value. Dynamics? Dynamics is different, but not so much. You see, many people also here yesterday talk about the window of opportunity. So now there is a theta function injected to both, Heaviside function to both RS neuron and FS neuron. So those neurons show this window of opportunity. When RS neuron fire, FS neurons also fire, they inhibit the RS neuron. RS neuron immediately shut down. And but because of depression, the activity of RS neuron emerges slowly, and eventually the activity is positive. This is because, by the way, this bump is because of the RS to RS popular activity, RS to RS synapses. Yes?
So if you give an input again, what happens?
So here? If you input again, it will increase by somewhat. So
it will also be a very short.
Okay, the question is, what do you mean input again? You get first you should turn off this activity.
Yeah, another step increase.
If the step increases, then it will increase a little bit, and you have this, so you have something like that. If you turn it off, then it takes some time for this to recover. The time scale of facilitation and depression, so hundreds of milliseconds, and then it starts again. Yes.
If you take a different type of facilitation dynamics, then this effect is probably from FS.
Oh, here there's no facilitation. This is FS.
On the slide before, that just shift.
Actually, no. The slide before with the LTS, Actually, that is important in depression, but I'll talk about it. Even if you take the different type of facilitation, then what limited the effect at the high rate is not facilitation, it's depression. That's actually what matters. I think that's one of the take-home messages.
Which one? Two? Three? Missing take-home messages?
You count them at the end and they're giving them. RS to LTS FS network. So now you have this network with both LTS to RS. So of course you can get what you got before, but yes.
So, I may have missed something. So now you're modeling like populations of a thing. Like you're not looking at individual dynamics.
Exactly. With rate model, this simple structure of the rate model, each population has one variable or several variables. Yes, exactly. So this is again the it's very hard. It's hard for me to think about a simpler description. I don't know. I think this is the simplest one that I can think about. RS to LTS FS network, and even this simplest description can give you some interesting dynamics. So here, under second condition, you can get from this network, you can get slow oscillation. So what you get here, these guys and this guy get input, these guys do not get input. MR, the activity of the RS neurons, oscillates from, let's say, call it a more active state, and this is a less active state. FS neuron fire at the same phase, or are active the same phase with the RS neuron, so they fire during the more active state, and they are quiescent during the less active state. And LTS neurons are active in antiphase. So when the RS neurons are in the low, less active state, and FS neurons are quiescent, LTS neurons are active. By the way, this is not the slow oscillation, this state is not the slow oscillation that you talked about, because in this slow oscillation, RS neurons are completely quiescent during the down state. That's not this